In 1545, the Catholic Church responded to the Protestant Reformation by calling together the Council of Trent.
Rome defines itself now as committed to this proposition that you are only justified by being changed into a different moral person by the grace of God. This is so important because it remains the essential difference between Protestantism and Rome.
The Catholic Church didn't ignore the Reformation. It got Rome's attention. There's no question about that. And today on Renewing Your Mind, Dr. W. Robert Godfrey will point out that there were many within the Roman Catholic Church who saw the same need to reform. We've been studying here with Dr. Godfrey over the past several months as he's taken us on a survey of church history. The Protestant Reformation has been our focus over the past several weeks, and as we'll see today, while Catholic reformers shared many concerns with Luther and the other Protestant reformers, their vision for renewal took them to a very different place. Let's join Dr. Godfrey now as he teaches this lesson titled, The Catholic Reformation.
Well, we have been looking at the Protestant Reformation and looking at some of its principal leaders and what they taught and, to some extent, how they attracted a following. But, of course, the Roman Catholic Church was not idle in these years, was certainly not indifferent to what was happening. And so I think it would be appropriate to take a little time now to look at the Roman Catholic Church. We often look at it under the title the Counter-Reformation, which stresses the reactions of the Roman Catholic Church to the Protestant Reformation, and we will look at that. But increasingly, historians also want to talk about what they call the Catholic Reformation. Even before Luther came along, there were Roman Catholics who saw a need for change in their church. They saw the need for at least moral improvement, and possibly some of them calling for doctrinal clarification. Things had gotten pretty bad in the Roman Catholic Church. Pope Leo X, the one who would excommunicate Luther, when he was elected pope, being from the distinguished, rich, and influential Medici family in Florence, he said, "Let us enjoy the papacy." And this was an attitude that had infected many. Being pope was not so much a solemn religious responsibility, but it had become a position of wealth, of political power, and often of excess in a variety of ways. At the end of the 15th century, one of the popes, Alexander VI, was Rodrigo Borgia. Maybe you know that name, Borgia. He kept his mistress in the Vatican rather openly and promoted his illegitimate children, Cesare Borgia, to be a rather influential politico and church figure, and advanced the cause of his daughter Lucretia, one of the famous poisoners of the era. So things had really degenerated morally in the papacy. Luther would refer to Alexander VI as the Mysterium Iniquitatis, the mystery of iniquity. It was a mess in parts of the Roman Church, and there were people who knew that there was a need for change. There was a need for improvement. And some of those voices had been raised before Luther came along. There were some who tried to start new monastic orders that would bring a new commitment to asceticism in the Roman Church. So there were the beginnings of change. Erasmus had called for moral improvement in the church as a great humanist leader. But of course, the emergence of Luther and the profound following that he attracted really put the pressure on the Roman Catholic Church to make changes, to improve. And the great question, of course, was how to do this. How do we make fundamental changes? What needs to be changed? And some were concerned that any concessions to the Protestants would undermine the claim of the Roman Catholic Church to being unchanged and unchangeable and pure and perfect. And others thought there had to be change if the church was to be saved. The calls then began to come in that there should be an ecumenical council to talk about the state of the church and to decide what changes needed to be made in the life of the church. But the popes were very leery about an ecumenical council because they looked back on the previous century when councils had been held and tried to liberate themselves from the control of the pope and challenged the pope for control of the church. And the popes didn't want to open that can of worms all over again. And so they were very leery about the calling for a council, but finally decided this is what was really necessary. And under Pope Paul III, a call was issued to the church to come to a great ecumenical council. Now, Luther had said, if we're going to have a council, it needs to be a free Christian council on German soil. Now, by free, Luther meant free from papal control. By Christian, he meant using the Bible as the standard for truth. And on German soil, he said, so those Italians won't ruin everything. So the Pope had no intentions of having a council that was free according to Luther's definition, but he did decide it might be wise to make a concession and have the council on German soil. So they agreed to have the council at Trent. Now, this was sort of cheating because Trent is in northeastern Italy, but at that time was technically a part of the Holy Roman Empire. And so in some ways it could be called a city on German soil. In any case, the council gathered, and there were some very distinguished scholars there. And in its first session in 1545, they took up what were probably the two most controversial issues, namely justification and the Bible and tradition. These were the great areas where the Protestants had made such headway in their preaching, justification and the authority of the Bible relative tradition. And Rome recognized they had no official teaching on these subjects. There was a general consensus in the Middle Ages on these subjects, but there had never been a decree of an ecumenical council. There had never been an official papal proclamation. And so many theologians in the church said, we need definition here so that we can say with clarity what our position is and why the Protestant position is wrong. And that first session at the Council of Trent worked hard at that and was relatively successful in making a clear statement. They said very clearly that the Bible is the Word of God. It is authoritative in the life of the church. But all of God's revelation is not contained in the Bible. God has also revealed himself through holy tradition. And specifically, they said, the holy tradition that binds and directs the Holy Church is revelation God gave to the apostles, but was not written down in the Bible. So all of authority in the church, Trent says, is apostolic, either through written apostolic work or oral apostolic teaching. Now, this is really important later, because by the 19th century, the Catholic Church is under tremendous pressure to recognize that many of its traditions cannot possibly be apostolic in order. History has reached a point where we know so much more about the history of the ancient church and what the ancient church did do and what it didn't do. And so many of the traditions that Rome had long claimed were apostolic were clearly not apostolic in origin. And in another session, we'll talk about how Rome then has to sort of change its definition of tradition to meet these new historical facts. But we mustn't let them off the hook. Their ecumenical council said, the binding tradition that we add to the Bible is apostolic in origin. And Rome has a way, in fact, a very famous Roman Catholic scholar in the 20th century said, well, what we do as Roman Catholics is we assert our great love of the Council of Trent. We assert our agreement with the Council of Trent. And then we ignore the Council of Trent and go beyond it. And we as Protestants have to say, Either the Pope is infallible and the councils are infallible and irreformable, or they're not. And you can't just ignore them and go on. You're stuck with them, if we can put it that way. And we as Protestants have to be rather insistent about that. So Rome does say very clearly in the Council of Trent that Bible and apostolic tradition unwritten is authoritative in the life of the church. Calvin, in looking at that, said, you know, we could almost agree with that. Because Rome can never demonstrate that any of its traditional practices or teachings are from apostolic unwritten testimony. It's simply an act of faith on the part of Rome that you declare those things. You can't demonstrate them. You can't prove them. There's no, as the moderns would say somewhat annoyingly, there's no there there. So Calvin tweaks them. He writes a very interesting antidote to Trent in which he is charmingly sarcastic, in my judgment. I wouldn't feel that way if I were Roman Catholic, but it was. It's very interesting. Then they come to justification. And here they achieve a really remarkable level of clarity. And they say, we are justified by being morally changed. Here is the embodiment and summary of what had generally been taught in the Middle Ages, but had never been officially defined, that God loves the lovely. For God to love you, you need to become a different person. You are not loved because of the external righteousness of Christ imputed to you. You are loved because Christ comes into you and changes you so you're a different person so that you can be loved by God. That's a rather brief summary of a rather long document, but that's the very heart of it. Rome defines itself now as committed to this proposition that you are only justified by being changed into a different moral person by the grace of God. This is so important because it remains the essential difference between Protestantism and Rome. And it relates very much to this matter of assurance that we talked about. If you have to be a morally better person to be accepted by God, how much better do you have to be? How do you have any confidence that you've gotten there? And of course, Rome's pastoral position is, you shouldn't be confident. You ought to be worried. You'll try harder if you're doubting. It is not good for you to have assurance. That's just Protestant arrogance. One of the great Roman Catholic theologians of the late 16th, early 17th century, Robert Bellarmine, said, the essential Protestant heresy is the arrogance of assurance. You'll get lazy if you're assured. You won't try hard if you're assured. It's good to be doubting and fearful and uncertain. So you have really two quite different religions at work here. Calvin said the assured heart in Christ will live for God out of gratitude. And we might ask ourselves, which religion historically has been more successful in promoting holiness? Now, this is a little nasty, but I don't think it's too much to say that the Roman Catholic Church has been at least somewhat indifferent in its relationship to the mafia, whereas Calvinism produced something called Puritanism. Those Puritans, boy, they were lazy livers. No, of course not. Puritans are famous for their commitment to a disciplined, holy Christian life. And I think here we can say, in a sense, the proof is in the pudding. Calvinism produced much more serious pursuers of holiness as a whole group as compared, I think, with Roman Catholicism. Because Roman Catholicism has this notion that you can live, they don't recommend this, but you can live any way you like and have the priest there at the last moment and everything will be all right. And this is not a way, I think, to promote holiness. So here is the great accomplishment of that first session of the Council of Trent. A statement on justification, a statement on the Bible, and then Trent adjourned. And there were some voices who said, you know, I'm not sure I like these decisions. There were people like Contarini, who was a cardinal, who said, I don't think it's clearly enough Augustinian. Interesting. There were still voices in the Roman Catholic Church that wanted to teach grace alone. They didn't want to teach faith alone, but they wanted to teach grace alone. And they were concerned that maybe Trent, in its first session, had compromised grace alone. That's still debated to some extent in the Roman Catholic Church to this day, because there's language of cooperating with grace in the Council of Trent. What exactly does that mean? In any case, initially, the Pope did not promulgate or officially approve the decisions of the first session of the Council of Trent. Nobody knew. Is this going to actually come to anything or not? Then, sometime later in 1551, another pope, Julius III, summons the Council of Trent back into action. And there they defined the seven sacraments of the church to clarify where they stood on the sacraments over against the Protestant teaching on two sacraments. Again, Trent adjourned. Again, the pope did not promulgate the decrees. Again, there was uncertainty about what was going to happen. And then in 1561, the council was called back into session for a third time. So this is a long, almost 20-year period, finally, by the adjournment of the council in 1663. And there, the council addressed the subject of the sacrifice of the Mass, how the Mass must be seen as a sacrifice, a propitiatory sacrifice. When the priest stands at the altar, this remains the official teaching of the Roman Catholic Church to this day, when the priest stands at the altar, he offers Christ to God, and that offering is propitiatory. It turns away the wrath of God. Now, we as Protestants need to be careful not to misrepresent what Rome teaches. Rome wants adamantly to deny this is another sacrifice of Christ. They don't want us to say Christ is sacrificed again, but they do want to say absolutely Christ is sacrificed on the altar, and that sacrifice turns away the wrath of God. And that's why for pious Roman Catholics, what happens at the altar is so critical to their religion. The priest at the altar turns bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ and then offers Christ to God as a sacrifice. And it's almost as if you're standing at Calvary. Christ is there just as he was at Calvary in his body and blood. And Christ is sacrificed just as he was at Calvary on the altar of the church. And that's why pious Roman Catholics feel they are so in the presence of God when they're at the Mass. And this is why Calvin said Protestants should never attend a Mass, because it's the essential act of idolatry. And this was all reasserted, wasn't brand new at Trent, but it was reasserted by Trent in its third session. The other thing that Trent did was to introduce some practical reforms. And this, in a sense, was amongst the most important things that happened in the Counter-Reformation. The church recognized it had at least two major problems beyond moral problems. The first was so many bishops did not live in their diocese. This was the problem of pluralism. A man could be made a bishop of a whole bunch of dioceses, and obviously he couldn't be resident in any of them, and many bishops preferred to live in Rome anyway. So many, many dioceses had no bishop. The bishop was supposed to be the pastor of the priests. If the bishop is absent, there's not the kind of supervision that's needed. So one of the things that Trent took rather effective action on was to end pluralism and to encourage bishops to be present in the lives of their diocese. The other thing it addressed was the problem of education. They recognized that many priests were not well educated. And therefore, Trent called for a seminary to be established in every diocese, or at least in every archdiocese. And this led to a whole renewal of the Roman Catholic priesthood as an educated body of people. There were many priests before the Reformation who really knew hardly anything more than how to memorize the Mass in Latin. They didn't even know entirely what it meant. They just went through the motions. And when the Protestant preachers came along, well educated in the Bible, they were able to destroy many of these priests in a debate. But the Council of Trent encouraged and over time was successful in producing a much better educated priesthood than it had had before. I think it's worth pausing for a moment and reflecting on one of the great dangers to Protestantism today is an increasingly uneducated ministry. Now, I'm president of a seminary, so I'm paid to make this speech, but I think it's true beyond what I'm paid to say. We need an educated ministry. It's not enough to be a good speaker and a good marketer and stand up and draw a crowd. That doesn't make you a preacher. That doesn't make you a truthful interpreter of the Bible. And I really think Ligonier Ministry is a great asset to the church in encouraging educated ministers and educated laity, because together we need to know the Bible to be able to stand against error and to stand for the truth. But these practical reforms really helped reinvigorate the Roman Catholic Church. It was successful then in forcing back the advance of the Reformation in many places where the Reformation initially seemed to be very successful. One of the places where the Reformation was very successful was Poland. You don't think of Poland as a Protestant country. And you don't think of it as a Protestant country because the Reformation was very effectively rolled back in Poland. And it was rolled back there particularly through the work of the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus. The Society of Jesus was the last great monastic order founded. It's in some ways kind of late medieval, in some ways modern. It was founded by Ignatius Loyola. Ignatius Loyola was a Spaniard who'd been a soldier. He was wounded in battle, trying to recover from his injuries. He felt he had received a very serious spiritual call to sort of be a soldier for Christ spiritually. And out of that, he founded the Society of Jesus, a group of, I think we can call them monks, at least they were a society of religious, separated order, who were determined to initially go to the Holy Land as crusaders and win the Holy Land for Christ, but when they weren't able to do that, they stayed in Europe and really became, as one scholar put it, the shock troops of the Counter-Reformation. They became very effective in laboring in various parts of Europe to turn back the Reformation. They were very well educated. They were very disciplined. They got involved in some important missionary work. Francis Xavier was the first great Western missionary to go to India and then on to Japan and to China. He was a close personal associate of Ignatius Loyola. So there's a lot of spiritual energy being pumped back into the Roman Catholic Church. There is a new confidence as time goes on in the Roman Catholic Church that they won't be overwhelmed and swept away by the Protestants. And Loyola is one of the voices that encourages an absolute devotion to the Roman Catholic Church. Loyola famously said, "I would believe that black is white if the church said so." And it was that kind of absolute devotion against what we as Protestants believe is a clear teaching of Scripture, reasserted traditional Roman theology and practice, gave it definition, and gave it a whole new cadre of people to carry it out and to reinforce it. And so the Counter-Reformation accomplished many of its purposes. So as we conclude this lecture, we can see that Protestantism has always faced enemies and opposition. Shouldn't be surprised about that. Jesus predicted that in this world we would have conflict and suffering, and we see that in the great renewal of Roman Catholicism in the 16th and 17th century in particular.
So many differences are revealed when we study the results of the Catholic Reformation, and we see that those differences remain. You're listening to Renewing Your Mind on this Saturday as Dr. Robert Godfrey continues his survey of church history. Dr. Godfrey is a respected church historian. He's president emeritus of Westminster Seminary, California, and one of our teaching fellows here at Ligonier Ministries. We're grateful for this series that he taught over the course of 4 years, covering church history from the very earliest days through the modern era. We think that a series like this is important for believers to help us understand the background of our faith. For your gift of any amount, we will send you this 73-lesson set on 12 DVDs. You can find us at renewingyourmind.org, or you can call us at 800-435-4343. Knowing and understanding church history is a great deterrent to repeating errors that we see in the past. As we study these faithful men and women who stood for truth and fought against false teaching, it gives us courage to do the same today. For your gift of any amount, we'll be happy to send you this 73-lesson set on 12 DVDs. Again, our phone number is 800-435-4343, or you can make your request and give your gift online at renewingyourmind.org. And as you consider the amount of your gift, please keep in mind the size and scope of this valuable resource. Technology is acknowledged as one of the reasons the Protestant Reformation was able to take place. Luther's 95 Theses, keep in mind, were spread far and wide because of the new technology of Gutenberg's printing press. In a similar way, it's been said that the Internet is today's printing press. It allows us to spread information quickly and broadly. We here at Ligonier Ministries are utilizing this technology. One way we're doing that is through RefNet, our 24-hour Internet radio station. RefNet provides sound biblical teaching and preaching, Bible reading, music, news, and more. We hope to spread the message of the historic Christian faith to as many people as possible. And by the way, this is a free resource. You can listen anytime at refnet.fm, or you can download the free RefNet app. Well, it's such an encouragement to hear from those of you who are enjoying Dr. Godfrey's series. A fellow church member stopped me after worship last Sunday and told me how much he appreciates this series. That's why we hope you'll join us again next Saturday as Dr. Godfrey focuses on the Scottish Reformation. In spite of great government persecution, the Reformation took root in Scotland, largely through the persistent ministry of a man named John Knox. We'll see you next Saturday here on Renewing Your Mind.